Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
I also think that if we can do this, if we can basically create a global social movement for a fair, effective solution to climate change, it'll be an overwhelming example of what it is that people can accomplish when they simply do it themselves and do not assume that the elites that are supposed to be leading us sensibly, you know, leave the decisions to them, because they have boggled this so badly that we have to solve it ourselves. And if we succeed in doing that, the example of successful popular mobilization solving great human problems will be so overwhelmingly positive that it will just lead to all sorts of other things, you know, that we can accomplish.
That's the voice of radical economist, professor and author Dr. Robin Hanel. On this week's show, we speak to Dr. Hanel about charting a road forward and the importance of a global social movement against climate change. Stay tuned.
You are listening to Latin Waves. We're very privileged this morning to be joined by Dr. Robin Hanel. He is the author of The People, By the People, A Case for Participatory Economics, now available in Spanish. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be with you again, Sylvia.
Now, when we think about the world and the kinds of economic practices through which we're invited to envision the world, you know, we have been socialized in a world that presents capitalism as a natural occurrence, something that just happened and that we're all now invited to participate. But I think in understanding our relationship with the world, we also need to understand the relationship that global capitalism has had with imperialism and how the two kind of interconnect. How do we then break out of a system of capitalism that reduces us to consumers?
Imperialism long preceded capitalism. There were empires where different groups of people dominated, conquered, and subjugated other groups of people long before capitalism. But in modern times, capitalism has become more global and more integrated. It's penetrated literally every little nook and corner of the planet, not just geographically, but the parts of our lives. Increasingly, our lives are basically driven as a market-driven process. The parts of our lives that really were separate from the capitalist economy have shrunk, even in societies that were capitalist. And then geographically, capitalism has spread every place. With the demise of the so-called socialist bloc, capitalism has rapidly spread into Russia, China. And therefore, what's happened and what's clear now is that imperialism and global capitalism are really all one. We now have achieved a level of integration of not only just global capitalism, but how it is that the imperialist aspects of today's world are intertwined with the globalist capitalist project. That's what we're witnessing. That's the era that we are now in. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's leading to misery for humans. Increasingly so, because it's become an increasingly irrational kind of global capitalism. It's fomenting wars, you know, that now are increasing in violence and death tolls. And it's, you know, hell-bent on destroying the natural environment and creating climate change that it may prove impossible to recover from. Mm-hmm. So the urgency of replacing global imperialist capitalism, has never been greater.
Our actions are not taken in a vacuum, you know, and they affect one another. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the impact then that our movements to reject this notion of our whole being one of consumption and production and interconnecting to a different vision of the world, one of communal integration, of communal participation, where we're both the recipients of reciprocal respect, but we also have a responsibility to create and connect the lead to coexistence, the lead to sustainability and a world with justice, not just for our own little corner, but for all people.
We do live in a more interconnected world. And I mean, this is a debate amongst those who study the globalization process. One reaction to the globalization process, because it has been organized and conducted in a way that is so destructive of local communities and cultures, is to reject integration of any kind. And that's very natural and understandable. And sometimes that's the practical thing that one must do. You must basically try and protect your community, your country, you know, from the destructive process of neoliberal capitalist globalization. On the other hand, there's a positive vision of globalization, which is one of increasing equitable cooperation amongst people everywhere, including knowledge and awareness of other people's cultures far, far beyond what people were capable of having 100 years ago. That's what makes the thinking through how to respond sometimes very difficult. The big picture is that we know what's fair and we know what's just and we know what democracy means and entails. And as long as we remember that that's what we're fighting for, and as long as we remember that what global capitalism and imperialism about, what they are about is the economics of competition and greed, and the process of domination of one people by some other groups. That's what we have to defeat. That's what we have to organize and defeat before it's too late. And instead, we have to continue to develop more and more ways of actually growing and behaving in a way that is true to our values and our desires. And I just call that the economics of equitable cooperation. And in terms of imperial relations, it's basically peaceful coexistence amongst friendly peoples. That's the vision on the other side that we have to understand. That's what we're fighting for against all the odds.
Can we talk a little bit about the significance of one good example? And perhaps we could use Venezuela, or we can use Bolivia, or you can choose. But I wonder if we could talk a little bit about how do we break out this prison, you know, of imagining the world simply along the lines of what has been imposed. I was thinking about, you know, the ultimate authority sometimes is just the unquestioned beliefs that we participate in, the things that we just take for granted and fall into.
Well, I think that people's ability to think about alternatives has clearly increased over the past 10 to 15 years. There's an increasing curiosity on the part of younger generations. Positive examples are very, very important. It's not sufficient to say, theoretically, I can show you there's a different way that's a better way. You actually have to demonstrate the practical reality of that. But we're getting more of that, too. Some people call it the future economy. Some people call it the new economy. There are two things going on in two different parts of the world. Places like Latin America and places in the countries called the BRICS, they are, first of all, standing up to European, North American-led global imperialism. They're saying, we're not going to put up with that anymore. We're no longer just your tools to be manipulated. And that's for the good. Also within their countries, and within many of those countries, they are experimenting with new and better ways to do things that actually are better for the environment and more humane and better for their populaces. Inside Europe and the United States and Canada and North America and Europe, as neoliberalism persists, even despite the crisis it's created, more and more people in local areas are discovering, well, we're just going to have to pick up and do things ourselves, and we're going to do them in the ways that make sense to us. So we have more and more examples of that's the kind of economics that works, that serves people's needs and protects the environment. And neoliberal capitalism doesn't work. It's on a destruction path.
It's beautiful when we think about the BRICS country, you know, Brazil, Russia, China, India, South Africa. I mean, these are countries heavily populated where the numbers of people alone speak to the volume of a new idea. But I wonder if we could talk a little bit about the principles then that we need to have in place for a participatory economic, one that begins from the bottom up, one that, you know, propels us to see the world in precisely this egalitarian, collaborative nature that you're speaking of.
Well, the principles have been ones around for a long, long time. You know, the French Revolution was liberty, equality, and solidarity. And this predates really the socialist movement of the century that followed the French Revolution. And those have been the ideals of people fighting for a better world for a long, long time now. And being clear about, well, when we say we want democracy, we want political democracy, and does democracy have to be confined to the political sphere of social life? Most of us spend most of our life in economic activities. And is there some reason that those decisions can't also be made in a democratic way? And as a democratic way also need to be vibrant and grassroots and participatory rather than representative? Can you organize it so it will be that way? We have to think clearly about democracy and decision-making and what we want. And, you know, one of the good things in this area is we live in a more educated world than the world has ever been before. In human history, the percentage of the population who have been taught enough so that they are capable of understanding what's going on and making decisions for themselves that are sensible, sound decisions, the percentage of the population globally that is capable of that has been increasing dramatically. And I think that one of the things that will happen over the next century is they will demand the right to exercise an ability that they now have. We need to remember that we can do all this fairly and justly and treat one another fairly and justly, and if we don't, it leads to problems and what it is that requires thinking that through. And then remembering that at this point, this has to be done urgently, you know, in a way that is consistent with preventing climate change and then going on to protect the planet and the natural environment in ways that humans have never, never done. Those are the things that we need to concentrate on. And if we always keep very clearly in mind that those are the goals, that's the criteria that we judge different programs and actions against, then I think we steer right, and I think that eventually will prevail.
As an environmentalist economist, you challenge us to look at the world in a more integrated way, you know, where our social movements need to have both, you know, this political economy in our minds, but also our connection to the land, our connection to the kinds of process that we're putting forward as, you know, practical ways of creating jobs. So where are the shifts that we need to make as a society?
Well, I think one of the concepts that the founders of the ecological economics movement provided that's very, very useful, and he said that, you know, for a long time, humans lived in a mostly empty world, but now we live in a mostly full world, and the difference is immense. Now, what's interesting is when we lived in a mostly empty world, we, for the most part, acted in very destructive ways vis-a-vis the natural environment. But the natural environment was so, so big and huge and resilient compared to the magnitude of the negative effects of human activities for most human history that it just didn't matter that much. But now that's no longer the case. We now live in a world where the environmental consequences of everything we do has to be very, very carefully considered and calibrated. And the other thing that in this area that I think is overwhelmingly becoming clearer is that the environmental movements as they arose, you know, in the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, climate change was not the principal motivator of environmental organizations, NGOs, and environmental activism. And so a lot of environmental activism has been focused on local attempts to protect particular parts of the environment. Or to prevent certain kinds of pollution. But we now understand that we have created an environmental threat that really overwhelms all of the others. Imagine if every environmental group was completely successful in protecting this river, the salmon species here, we bring them back, we knock the dams down, that was all a mistake, we recreate Salmon Nation in the Northwest, British Columbia, Oregon, Washington State, Northern California. Even if we were successful at doing all that, if we do not prevent cataclysmic climate change over the next 100 years, all of the environmental gains that have been gained locally, all of those improvements, are just going to be wiped away. So we absolutely have got to respond to this new challenge. And the powers that be, the global elites, the international negotiations, the legislative, the political parties, We're getting no action on this front. In Washington, D.C., there's gridlock on this issue. In Europe, it's been put on the back burner. In Canada, it's been buried, the need pauperism and exploiting natural resources. At the international negotiations level, we've been taking steps backwards. So there is no choice but trying to organize a massive global movement to solve the climate change problem before it's too late. I also think that if we can do this, if we can basically create a global social movement for a fair, effective solution to climate change, it'll be an overwhelming example of what it is that people can accomplish when they simply do it themselves and do not assume that the elites that are supposed to be leading us sensibly, you know, leave the decisions to them. Because they have boggled this so badly that we have to solve it ourselves. And if we succeed in doing that, the example of successful popular mobilization solving great human problems will be so overwhelmingly positive that it will just lead to all sorts of other things, you know, that we can accomplish as this century moves along. But if we do not solve that problem by the end of the century, the planet's not going to be worth living in. And if we do solve the problem, it'll be because people solved it, and that will be a wonderful positive example for humanity.
You know, one of the things that I'm very concerned about is when sometimes even those who are supposed to be on the progressive side entertain ideas that, you know, we treat the problem as if it was an equal divide, you know? We know that 90% of the population agrees that climate change is real, that we need to act, we don't have a way to deal with nuclear waste, and so we should stop that project. We know that coal mines, you know, are completely disastrous to a lot of our local economies, you know, natural economies, because an economy is not just money bartering, changing hands. An economy is also a living economy, you know, a river, a beautiful lake, you know, that has multiple beings that you can feed from and, you know, be part of. It's also an economy, you know, a different kind of community that we all benefit from. So what are the alternatives? You know, what are the alternatives and the things that we as communities engage must now take on without this nonsense of sitting on the fence of, you know, but 10% say that it's this and treat it as if it was, you know, an equal divide of ideas, but rather instead of taking decisive action to move in the direction of creating a world that's ecologically, socially, culturally, politically sustainable.
The scientific community is just remarkably unanimous about the seriousness of the threat of climate change and remarkably unanimous about the degree to which we have simply got to wean ourselves off of fossil fuels, you know, incredibly rapidly. So from people who studied this, the scientific experts, we don't have a tremendous amount of disagreement. Now, in the United States, the fossil fuel industry is you know, they have funded some think tanks and they have funded phony research that, you know, quotes itself back and forth to pretend that there's, you know, there are two sides to this issue amongst the scientists. That is a bunch of malarkey. There are no two sides on this issue among scientists. In terms of political interests, it's really the fossil fuel industry against the world. Mm-hmm. They're the ones who have everything to lose because they own the assets that are under the ground. And what the scientists are telling us is you cannot take them out and burn them. If you do that, the planet is destroyed. So, of course, they are doing absolutely everything they can. And in the United States, the fossil fuel industry was it's been the most powerful, successful political lobby in the history of the country. It has run energy policy for 150 years or more in this country, and it continues to do so and obstruct progress. On the other hand, ordinary people are not just aghast at the fact that nothing is being done. There are more and more businesses and industries that are discovering that, oh my God, the fossil fuel industry is just going to take us all down. So the possibilities of doing something, you know, there are many, many positive aspects of what it is that we can do, and there's many reasons to be hopeful. But one of the things we have to do is we have to be much more successful at waging political battles and warfare. In this area, it's really important that radicals who believe in system change learn how to work constructively with people, you know, who are absolutely dedicated to preventing climate change, but who have not yet decided whether or not they think this requires system change. We can't have radicals saying, well, I'm not going to even participate in a fight around any sort of campaign to stop climate change unless they are calling for system change, because after, I mean, everybody knows I know that capitalism is the problem. That's what's causing climate change. So unless you're going to call for replacement of capitalism, there can't be any solution. And then you have many, many more people who, you know, haven't gotten the message that capitalism needs to be replaced. And they're out there fighting in all sorts of very practical ways to try and do things to stop this problem. We have to do a much better job of seeing that the reformers and the radicals do not undercut one another. We each have our job. We each have things we can do well to stop climate change. And we need to all do that in a more collaborative and cooperative way, or else we are going to get beat by the world's most successful lobby, and that's the fossil fuel industry globally.
That's beautiful, and I'm so glad that you mentioned that, because I think we need everybody, you know, and we don't all have the same lived experience. We haven't all lived next to a mine that completely, you know, undermined the livelihood and the lives of the people there. So sometimes the idea of system change hasn't yet occurred to us because our lived experience has not been so dire, you know, and it takes some time to get there. But I think, as you point out, we need everybody, and the more we can collaborate in cooperate with each other, the more successful we will be. Please tell our audience, how can people access your book, Of the People, By the People, A Case for a Participatory Economy?
Well, it's distributed by AK Press. As you said, there's a Spanish language edition now for people who speak Spanish. That was published by a press called Icaria Press. It's in Barcelona, Spain. And you should always try and get books through some sort of left progressive media distributor, bookstore, or whatever, because it's important that we keep an alternative media alive. And the Amazons of the world are killing them. On the other hand, if you have no other way to get these books, you, of course, can get them through Amazon. And the other book for people who are primarily concerned or interested with climate change and solutions to climate change and environmental issues, Green Economics, Confronting the Ecological Crisis, that's published by M.E. Sharp. That's also available in left progressive bookstores and through the regular outlets. I'm happy to say there's now some foreign language editions of the Green Economics. Turkey has a brand new foreign language edition of the Green Economics book, because in Turkey they're taking this issue very seriously.
Thank you so much for being with us, and thank you for not only participating but helping us create alternatives to how we organize, how we mobilize, and how we celebrate our journey together, because I think ultimately this needs to be a journey where we see each other and embrace our diversity as, you know, the strength of our movement. So thank you so much for all that you do to make us aware of the beautiful movements that are all over and that inform our steps as we move forward.
As always, it was a pleasure to be with you, and I do believe that Cascadia has an important role to lead the way in the way forward.
Thank you again. We will be at the Cascadia Media Conference on September 19th to the 21st. And if you're interested, come. You get to meet Dr. Robin Hanel in person. Hopefully you'll have books there as well.
I'll try to do that.
Take care. Talk to you soon.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Talking to you, Sylvia. Bye-bye.
Thank you. That was Dr. Robin Hanel. He is the author of the People, By the People, A Case for Participatory Economics. We have come to the end of our program. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program available to campus and community radios. Please visit our website, www.latinwavesmedia.com, to hear previous shows, connect to our media projects, and access other resources, or to support our efforts by making a safe PayPal contribution. I am Sylvia Richardson. Thanks for listening.